responses to this angelic figure, we remember and either laugh at because we can tell that the author is criticizing such human behavior, or that we're embarrassed about because we realize that's what I would have done, I suppose, and we see that it probably wouldn't have been the best response. It's one of the pieces of literature that I call the story of the other. The other, that meaning someone different from us. A couple of them that use this approach, Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. We know the general outlines of that. But if you haven't read that recently and choose to do so, you find out that the monster, who is not Frankenstein, the doctor who created the monster is Frankenstein. The monster has a good heart, good soul, and after he's been created. He's a good person. But the way he is treated by everyone who sees him, just throwing stones at him, screaming, running away, he wants to join the human community. And everyone reacts. And my interpretation of that is that the real monster in the story, Frankenstein, is us, because we turned him from a potentially good person, ugly though he is, wasn't his fault, into a terrifying person. And how many of you remember Herman Melville's story of Bartleby? You remember that one, the pale young man who arrives in a scrivener's office, take on a job of being really a human Xerox machine. That's what a scrivener was, copying documents. And whenever he's asked to do anything, he says, "I would prefer not to." I would prefer not to, which drives his employer crazy. And we watch through a fairly long story, about 40 pages, of especially the employer, but all the other people who encounter him do the wrong thing, for selfish reasons. How can you be the employer is embarrassed that he's got an employee who won't do what he wants him to. And everybody, the word gets around in the business circles. But I believe what Melville is doing is showing how all the human responses that Bartleby receives in that story are inappropriate. Nobody treats him in the way in which we are commanded to treat each other. Okay, here's a very old man with enormous wings. If I'm not speaking loudly enough, just wave your hand in the back and I'll try to repeat it a little louder. And try to keep in mind a few of the odd things that people do as they try to figure out this person. On the third day of rain, they had killed so many crabs inside the house that Pelayo had to cross his drenched courtyard and throw them into the sea, because the newborn child had a temperature all night, and they thought it was due to the stench. The world had been sad since Tuesday. Sea and sky were a single ash-gray thing, and the sands of the beach, which on March nights glimmered like powdered light, had become a stew of mud and rotten shellfish. The light was so weak at noon that when Pelayo was coming back to the house after throwing away the crabs, it was hard for him to see what it was that was moving and groaning in the rear of the courtyard. He had to go very close to see that it was an old man, a very old man, lying face down in the mud, who, in spite of his tremendous efforts, couldn't get up, impeded by his enormous wings. So there in the first paragraph, we've got the words of the title, "Very Old Man with Enormous Wings." Frightened by that nightmare, Pelayo ran to get Elisenda. You can tell by the names that this is an Hispanic kind of setting, probably the country Colombia, where Gabriel Marquez grew up. Alexander, his wife, who was putting compresses on the sick child, and he took her to the rear of the courtyard. They both looked at the fallen body with mute stupor. He was dressed like a rag picker. There were only a few faded hairs left on his bald skull, and very few teeth in his mouth, and his pitiful condition of a drenched great-grandfather had taken away any sense of grandeur he might have had. His huge buzzard wings, dirty and half-plucked, were forever entangled in the mud. They looked at him so long and so closely that Pelayo and Elisenda very soon overcame their surprise and in the end found him familiar. Then they dared speak to him, and he answered in an incomprehensible dialect with a strong sailor's voice. That was how they skipped over the inconvenience of the wings, and quite intelligently concluded that he was a lonely castaway from some foreign ship wrecked by the storm. It's a highly ironic statement by the narrator. Quite intelligently, they determined that. And yet they called in a neighbor who knew everything about life and death to see him. And all she needed was one look to show them their mistake. "He's an angel," she told them. "He must have been coming for the child." See, assuming that the child might be dying. "But the poor fellow is so old that the rain knocked him down." On the following day, everyone knew that a flesh and blood angel was held captive in Pelayo's house. Against the judgment of the wise neighbor woman, for whom angels in those times were the fugitive survivors of a celestial conspiracy, they did not have the heart to club him to death. Pelayo watched over him all afternoon from the kitchen, armed with the bailiff's club, and before going to bed he dragged him out of the mud and locked him up with the hens in the wire chicken coop. In the middle of the night, when the rain stopped, Pelayo and Elisenda were still killing crabs. A short time afterward, the child woke up without a finger and with a desire to eat. Then they felt magnanimous and decided to put the angel on a raft with fresh water and provisions for 3 days and leave him to his fate on the high seas. How magnanimous. But when they went out into the courtyard with the first light of dawn, they found the whole neighborhood in front of the chicken coop, having fun with the angel, without the slightest reverence, tossing him things to eat through the openings in the wire, as if he weren't a supernatural creature, but a circus animal. Father Gonzaga, the local priest, arrived before 7 o'clock, alarmed at the strange news. By that time, onlookers less frivolous than those at dawn had already arrived and were making all kinds of conjectures concerning the captive's future. The simplest among them thought that he should be named mayor of the world. Others of sterner mind felt that he should be promoted to the rank of a 5-star general in order to win all wars. Some visionaries hoped that he could be put to stud in order to implant on earth a race of winged wise men who can take charge of the universe. But Father Gonzaga, before becoming a priest, had been a robust woodcutter. Standing by the wire, he reviewed his catechism in an instant and asked them to open the door so that he could take a close look at that pitiful man who looked more like a huge, decrepit hen among the fascinated chickens. He was lying in a corner, drying his open wings in the sunlight among the fruit fields and breakfast leftovers that the early risers had thrown him. Alien to the impertinences of the world, he only lifted his antiquarian eyes and murmured something in his dialect when Father Gonzaga went into the chicken coop and said good morning to him in Latin. The parish priest had his first suspicion of an impostor when he saw that he did not understand the language of God or know how to greet his ministers. The angel can't understand Latin, the language of God. Then he noticed that seen close up, he was much too human. He had an unbearable smell of the outdoors. The backside of his wings was strewn with parasites, and his mane feathers had been mistreated by terrestrial winds, and nothing about him measured up to the proud dignity of angels. Then he came out of the chicken coop and, in a brief sermon, warned the curious against the risks of being ingenuous. That is, naive, you know, gullible. He reminded them that the devil had the bad habit of making use of carnival tricks in order to confuse the unwary. He argued that if wings were not the essential element in determining the difference between a hawk and an airplane, they were even less so in the recognition of angels. Nevertheless, he promised to write a letter to his bishop so that the latter would write to his primate, so that the latter would write to the supreme pontiff in order to get the final verdict from the highest courts. His prudence fell on sterile hearts. The news of the captive angel spread with such rapidity that after a few hours, the courtyard had the bustle of a marketplace, and they had to call in troops with fixed bayonets to disperse the mob that was about to knock the house down. Elisenda, her spine all twisted from sweeping up so much marketplace trash, then got the idea of fencing in the yard and charging 5 cents admission to see the angel. Entrepreneur. The curious came from far away. A traveling carnival arrived with a flying acrobat who buzzed over the crowd several times, but no one paid any attention to him because his wings were not those of an angel, but rather those of a sidereal bat. The most unfortunate invalids on earth came in search of health. A poor woman who since childhood had been counting her heartbeats and had run out of numbers. A Portuguese man who couldn't sleep because the noise of the stars disturbed him. A sleepwalker who got up at night to undo the things he had done while awake, and many others with less serious ailments. In the midst of that shipwrecked disorder that made the earth tremble, Pelayo and Elisenda were happy with fatigue, for in less than a week they had crammed their rooms with money, and the line of pilgrims waiting their turn to enter still reached beyond the horizon. The angel was the only one who took no part in his own act. He spent his time trying to get comfortable in his borrowed nest, befuddled by the hellish heat of the oil lamps and sacramental candles that had been placed along the wire. At first they tried to make him eat some mothballs, which, according to the wisdom of the wise neighbor woman, were the food prescribed for angels. But he turned them down, just as he turned down the papal lunches that the penitents brought him. And they never found out whether it was because he was an angel or because he was an old man that in the end he ate nothing but eggplant mush. His only supernatural virtue seemed to be patience, especially during the first days when the hens pecked at him, searching for the stellar parasites that proliferated in his wings, and the cripples pulled out feathers to touch their defective parts. And even the most merciful threw stones at him, trying to get him to rise so they could see him standing. The only time they succeeded in arousing him was when they burned his side with an iron for branding steers, for he had been motionless for so many hours that they thought he was dead. He awoke with a start, ranting in his hermetic language and with tears in his eyes, and he flapped his wings a couple of times, which brought on a whirlwind of chicken dung and lunar dust and a gale of panic that did not seem to be of this world. Although many thought that his reaction had been one not of rage but of pain, from then on they were careful not to annoy him, because the majority understood that his passivity was not that of a hero taking his ease, but that of a cataclysm in repose. Okay, we're halfway through. Father Gonzaga held back the crowd's frivolity with formulas of maidservant inspiration while awaiting the arrival of a final judgment on the nature of the captive. But the mail from Rome showed no sense of urgency. They spent their time finding out if the prisoner had a navel, if his dialect had any connection with Aramaic, how many times he could fit on the head of a pin, or whether he wasn't just a Norwegian with wings. Those meager letters might have come and gone until the end of time if a providential event had not put an end to the priest's tribulations. It so happened that during those days, among so many other carnival attractions, there arrived in town the traveling show of the woman who had been changed into a spider for having disobeyed her parents. The admission to see her was not only less than the admission to see the angel, but people were permitted to ask her all manner of questions about her absurd state and to examine her up and down so that no one would ever doubt the truth of her horror. She was a frightful tarantula the size of a ram and with the head of a sad maiden. What was most heartrending, however, was not her outlandish shape, but the sincere affliction with which she recounted the details of her misfortune. While still practically a child, she had sneaked out of her parents' house to go to a dance, and while she was coming back through the woods after having danced all night without permission, a fearful thunderclap rent the sky in two, and through the crack came the lightning bolt of brimstone that changed her into a spider. Her only nourishment came from the meatballs that charitable souls chose to toss into her mouth. A spectacle like that, full of so much human truth, and with such a fearful lesson, was bound to defeat, without even trying, that of a haughty angel who scarcely deigned to look at mortals. Besides, the few miracles attributed to the angel showed a certain mental disorder. And here are some miracles that he did. Like the blind man who didn't recover his sight, but grew three new teeth. Or the paralytic who didn't get to walk, but almost won the lottery. And the leper whose sores sprouted sunflowers. Those consolation miracles, which were more like mocking fun, had already ruined the angel's reputation when the woman who had been changed into a spider finally crushed him completely. That was how Father Gonzaga was cured forever of his insomnia, and Pelayo's courtyard went back to being as empty as during the time it had rained for 3 days and crabs walked through the bedrooms. The owners of the house had no reason to lament. With the money they saved, they built a two-story mansion with balconies and gardens and high netting so that the crabs wouldn't get in during the winter, and with iron bars on the windows so that angels wouldn't get in. Pelayo also set up a rabbit warren close to town and gave up his job as bailiff for good, and Elisenda bought some satin pumps with high heels and many dresses of iridescent silk, the kind worn on Sunday by the most desirable women in those times. The chicken coop was the only thing that didn't receive any attention. If they washed it down with creolin and burned tears of mirth inside it every so often, it was not in homage to the angel, but to drive away the dung heap stench that still hung everywhere like a ghost and was turning the new house into an old one. At first, when the child learned to walk, so now you see we're a year or two into the story, and the angel was still there. At first, when the child learned to walk, they were careful that he not get too close to the chicken coop. But then they began to lose their fears and got used to the smell, and before the child got his second teeth, he'd gone inside the chicken coop to play, where the wires were falling apart. The angel was no less standoffish with him than with the other mortals, but he tolerated the most ingenious infamies with the patience of a dog who had no illusions. They both came down with chicken pox at the same time, the child and the angel. The doctor who took care of the child couldn't resist the temptation to listen to the angel's heart, and he found so much whistling in the heart and so many sounds in his kidneys that it seemed impossible for him to be alive. What surprised him most, however, was the logic of his wings. They seemed so natural on that completely human organism that he couldn't understand why other men didn't have wings too. When the child began school, okay, now it's perhaps 5 years along, it had been some time since the sudden rain had caused the collapse of the chicken coop. The angel went dragging himself about here and there like a stray, dying man. They would drive him out of the bedroom with a broom, and a moment later find him in the kitchen. He seemed to be in so many places at the same time that they grew to think that he'd been duplicated, that he was reproducing himself all through the house. And the exasperated and unhinged Elisenda shouted that it was awful living in that hell full of angels. He could scarcely eat, and his antiquarian eyes had also become so foggy that he went about bumping into posts. All he had left were the bare canuli, those are the little hard parts that hold the feather into the skin. All that was left were the bare canuli of his last feathers. Belial threw a blanket over him and extended him the charity of letting him sleep in the shed. And only then did they notice that he had a temperature at night and was delirious with tongue twisters of an old Norwegian. That was one of the few times they became alarmed, for they thought he was going to die, and not even the wise neighbor woman had been able to tell them what to do with dead angels. Okay, we're at the last paragraph. And yet, he not only survived his worst winter, but seemed improved with the first sunny days. He remained motionless for several days in the farthest corner of the courtyard, where no one would see him. And at the beginning of December, some large, stiff feathers began to grow on his wings, the feathers of a scarecrow, which looked more like another misfortune of decrepitude. But he must have known the reason for those changes, for he was quite careful that no one should notice them, that no one should hear the sea chanties that he sometimes sang under the stars. One morning, Elisenda was cutting some bunches of onions for lunch when a wind that seemed to come from the high seas blew into the kitchen. Then she went to the window and caught the angel in his first attempts at flight. They were so clumsy that his fingernails opened a furrow in the vegetable patch, and he was on the point of knocking the shed down with the ungainly flapping that slipped on the light and couldn't get a grip on the air. But he did manage to gain altitude. Elisenda let out a sigh of relief for herself and for him when she saw him pass over the last houses, holding himself up in some way with the risky flapping of a senile vulture. She kept watching him, even when she was through cutting the onions, and she kept on watching until it was no longer possible for her to see him, because then he was no longer an annoyance in her life, but an imaginary dot on the horizon of the sea. Okay, what do we make of that? Do you have any? This was an angel, as decreed by the wise next door neighbor woman who knew everything about life and death? Or is he some kind of an inventor of things? The doctor examined the wings, and they were real wings on a human body, not something teaked on. Well, let's say we aren't sure at this point of what he really was. I think Flannery O'Connor would say that's clearly not the important thing about the story. The important thing is the spiritual journey of the people who encounter this decrepit old man with enormous wings. What did you notice about the human response to this being, who seemed to be like one of them, but he was all decrepit, probably Norwegian, and had wings.
Compassion.
Was there compassion?
I said a lack.
A lack of compassion. Yes.
I mean,
there was fright.
There was fright.
They were afraid of it.
Yeah.
They isolated him.
Yeah, isolated him. He's behind a fence and later in a shed and so forth.
They then also came to just ignore him.
Finally, they ignored him. There were some more interesting attractions in town, and
right.
Then, you know, they did come back to him anyway. Okay. Uncompassion. Fright. Isolation. I missed one there. Forgotten one of the things that got mentioned. Okay. Oh, what else? Yes.
It seems like it's a story about how do we treat others among us who are different, and this character is obviously very different. And the lack of hospitality, one of the reasons I thought of that word is Holden, it reaches out a hand of hospitality. And certainly there was not one bit of that. Do we use people? Do we abuse people? Do we, I mean, those who are different? And this was certainly a different character, but
yeah,
lack of hospitality.
That's a good comment. For us who are living in this hospitable place, lack of hospitality. And what would we do if a very old man with enormous wings landed right out here on the street? Would we be frightened? Would we be incompassionate? Would we be fully hospitable as we are to each other?
Jesus talks about the stranger among us.
That's right.
How do you treat the stranger among
us? That's right. And the story seems to be a classic illustration of that, doesn't it?
Exploitation,
right.
I mean,
the family into whose yard he lands become millionaires, you know, and build themselves a grandiose house. I know how I can profit from this.
But, you know, at first they thought they were protecting the child.
Yeah, the parents thought at first he might have come to save the child. In his presence healed the child, and so in gratitude they had decided to give him 3 days of provisions, put him on a raft, and send him out into the Pacific Ocean. You know, not very generous response.
No, I thought they thought that he was going to take the child.
Well, that they might have thought
that
the angel was going to take the child,
yeah.
But the child didn't die.
No.
And the angel didn't leave with or without the child. Now, the angel was still here when the child starts school, still in the household 5 years later, which is a little bizarre. Yeah, and it's... Don't feel bad if we can't explain everything, you know, about whether the angel was assumed to be arriving to heal the child or to take the child up to heaven or whatever. The story leaves enough ambiguities to encourage us to say, well, we don't know for sure, right? Yes.
I found it interesting that they were examining him, to the angel, to try to find out if it was really an angel.
That's right.
It has a navel.
Exactly. Examination is a good term for it. You know.
Is it real?
Is it real? How do we know for sure? You know. Can we just accept this without going through the scientific steps of determining. And the doctor who checked him out well, he's got real wings. He's got a human body. Then everyone began to speculate, well, you know, what were the things they wondered about the, is it how many of them would fit on the head of an eagle?
Was it poking at religion and
yeah.
discussion, but
right.
the
it's a,
more educated or less educated, I don't know how you talk about it, where they just talk circles around things that
right.
And that was humor on the part of
that's right. You can tell that the author here is poking fun at some extremities of religious speculation, as well as at what other aspect of religion about authority and these.
We couldn't
hierarchy.
Decide if it's an angel unless it came down from the hierarchy.
Right.
So
you had that the priest had to ask the Monsignor, who has to ask the bishop, who has to go to the supreme pontiff and say, what are we to think about this? And of course, they don't get an answer from the church, capital T, capital C.
But it couldn't be real because he didn't speak Latin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he didn't understand God's language, Latin. So this tells us something about the narrow-mindedness of this particular priest, at least, if not poking fun at the whole religious establishment.
If you think about these visions that people have of the Virgin Mary, of all these different things, there's usually a certain awe involved. But these crowds of people had no bad feelings about pulling out his feathers.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't even occur to them that he might be in a miserable state, and they just added to it.
Yeah. Yeah. There was curiosity, you know, long lines of people willing to pay 5 cents, which in the setting of this story is probably a considerable amount. So there's a lot of curiosity, which is, for most of us, a self-serving thing. You know, when there's something unusual, we want to say, I saw that. You know, I was there. I paid money and saw it. That's kind of a making oneself feel better, especially if the thing you saw was considered a lesser being, a little bit like going to the zoo, you know, we want to say we saw these creatures even though they were penned up and all the rest. Yes?
It kind of seemed as though they more or less just kind of forgot about him completely because they would come back just at certain times of the life of the child, but there really didn't seem to be a lot of continuation as far as back and forth for them. He was ignored.
Yeah, finally, when nobody could find out whether he was really an angel or some kind of charlatan, and when there was something more interesting to look at, like the woman who had been changed into a spider, and you could see her for less money, well, then this just stopped being a spectacle. And when you can't find, and this has a lot to do with how we think about religion and faith, if we can't find out for sure, well, then we just forget about it. This being has entered our community, our life, but since we can't find out for sure if he's an angel, except in the judgment of the wise woman who lives next door. Then finally, we lose interest. Go away. You had a question?
I'm interested in the fact that this figure, whatever it was, came and went and stayed a while. And they didn't understand how he came or how he left.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever, however they did it, or he did it, was beyond them. But they were so tied up with the figure that they saw, the dirt, the fleas, the age, that they didn't ever get to the point where they found out about it. He gave them plenty of time,
right.
5 years or whatever.
Yeah, there was plenty of time for them. But they gave up the, what might have been a real spiritual search for them, if they thought there was anything supernatural about this being. You'd think they'd have kept at it, but they gave up.
You might say, we're humans. Some of us have lived 80 years, and in that time, we've had all kinds of opportunity, but we have never broken through the bubble.
Yeah,
that's right. When I was 10, the Song of Bernadette came out, and it was this French woman who had seen the Virgin, the lady, she called her. And, oh, I was absolutely fascinated by that whole thing, and I mean, real spiritual thing. About 4 months after I saw the motion picture, there came in my neighborhood a sighting of a Virgin on the side of a building. It was within 20 blocks. So I went with a bunch of Catholic children to go see the Virgin. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited. And then I looked at the time and realized I had to be home for supper, and no Virgin appeared. Shattered all my hopes. And on top of it, and looking back on it, I thought it was probably the most comical thing I had done in my life.
About this, the sense of humor of it, because Marquez is so funny. He's really a yoga. He's a real mischief.
Yeah.
I haven't read the whole story, but it didn't seem like anybody got a lot of humor out of it or enjoyed it. It seemed like that last line in that D.H. Lawrence poem that she was reading the other night, where they had missed their chance of the Lord of Light. I mean, they could have had a lot of fun with it. I mean, Marquez is certainly having a lot of fun with it. But they weren't having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
And it was potentially a lot of fun.
Right, yeah.
And funny.
Yeah. Although he wasn't, the angel, wasn't providing too many clues, too many prompts for humor. Mm-hmm. And he was old, decrepit, he could hardly speak, and if he had been a stand-up angel, a one-liner, who could be a good comic, it might have been different. But he was fairly passive in the whole thing, isn't he?
It was just funny that something that might be divine or that might be an angel would be so decrepit. There's a lot of reversing of the flow there of how seriously we take ourselves, how seriously we take our angels, or how serious they should live up to their angelness, etc.
It's a little variation on the Frankenstein story, where Frankenstein was so ugly that everyone assumed he was a horror and a monster, but his heart was good. And this angel is, because he looks so weird and decrepit and unclean and all of that. The assumptions we often make about people who aren't as neat and clean as we are is that they are unworthy of our attention. Paul, I've got you.
Mine's more of a question. As readers, we can't even imagine all these crazy things. And those people, for 5 years, they go through their normal everyday steps, the things that they would normally do. Oh, we got to investigate all the words they have up there.
Yeah.
But there's never any imagination. And I just, so my question is, one, does that make any sense? But two, he just gave up on those people. I'm leaving. The angel.
The angel.
His wings grow back, right? Stronger, better.
Yeah.
And then, okay, You haven't done anything different than what you've been doing all your life. I'm out of here.
He's got the generous situation of being allowed to live in a shed behind this magnificent house, although he apparently occupies it a bit, but Alessandra always sweeps him out of the room because he's a nuisance. He has been a nuisance in her life, we hear at the very end.
Well, kind of like Frankenstein, the monster. We can't imagine him being anything but this evil thing. So we kill him.
Yeah. And this is one of the issues that I've mentioned with some of the other stories, is that we never know where grace is going to come, you know, through what person, you know, grace is going to reach us, or at what unusual situation, you know, a winter when the rained hard and the crabs were just crawling through the house, out of that should come an angel, you know, in that kind of a circumstance. So you have your doubts. But what many writers tell us, and I think Garcia Marquez is telling us here, you know, is that when something appears in our midst, they don't see him arrive, they just find him already there. What do we do about it? You know, are we hospitable or not? Are we frightened or not? Are we mean? Do we throw stones at something we don't understand, as these people threw stones? Do we go into lengthy theological arguments about did he speak Aramaic, or, you know, all these kinds of things? And they seem to make just about every mistake other than outright killing him. They thought about doing that at first, but finally changed their minds about it. Many, almost all the mistakes that we make when we aren't ready for this, for the news, we aren't ready for the arrival, we aren't ready for the unusual or the frightening. And it seems to me that the author here is showing a whole range of cultural responses, you know, these kinds of things. And most of us as readers, listeners, can find ourselves in there someplace. If we try to imagine what would I have done, I'd have paid 10 cents, I'm sure. see this. And might have gawked and shrugged my shoulders and gone off to look at the woman who'd been changed into a tarantula as more interesting. And she would talk back. She would explain, you know, how all this happened in her life. So there was, you know, more one might get from that. And of course, the examinations, we are empiricists. We need to see the evidence. The convict who, in Flannery O'Connor's story, kills the grandmother, says Jesus turned everything upside down. And I don't know if he was divine. I wish I would have been there so I'd have known. But I wasn't there. You know, he wanted to see it. And here we are without seeing divinity, except through other people who sometimes, you know, aren't as handsome as we are, as rich as we are, and we choose to ignore the moment when we have the opportunity, perhaps, to be blessed and graced. Now, I don't know, and I'm not sure Garcia Marquez, was intending for us all to believe that this was an angel sent from God, as we think of those creatures, or if he started fooling us with an impossibility. This is such an absurd, fantastic thing. The miracles that he he achieves. You know, somebody didn't learn to walk, but he almost won the lottery into a consummation miracle. I mean, these are good little jokes about things that we want to believe, you know, the Virgin Mary appearing on the wall of the house, you know, and so we have the hope that the miracle will touch us, but sometimes they don't turn it out at all. You know, you
they've made the angel into a sight from a freak show.
Yeah.
And the reason,
exactly.
The story kind of rubbed me the wrong way, or maybe the right way, what he intended to do, because I remember being the only kid in school who did not go to the freak show when the circus came around. And when I said to my mother, well, don't you want to go see the thin man and this and that? And she said, I do not want to see those people who have been given bodies that are not like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And pay money and make them, put them.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did to this.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's right.
It was extraneous.
Yeah.
It was like they treated him like an animal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, I mean, they even prodded him with a hot branding iron. Just to see if he was dead, you know. And,
so it's a very disturbing little story, because we will do those things, cruelty.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, it's a classic case of inhospitable behavior to the other, to the being who is not like us. And sometimes it can be dangerous to be too hospitable to the unknown, but if we live ungenerous lives, inhospitable lives, lives where we are neither being graceful, being the instruments of grace toward another, or putting ourselves in a situation to receive grace from someone or something that we don't quite understand, then our spiritual journey is a very sad one. And I think that that the author wants us to spend a couple days just thinking about, oh my goodness, you know, I need to be prepared. I need to be open. And I need to be open to something. We often pray, we believe in miracles, and we say, dear God, please save this dying child, or please, we usually don't ask to win the lottery, but, you know, please have good things happen. And these people were not good people in that regard. And I think that's the message he wants to give us. He knows he's writing half fantasy and half realism, and we know that as listeners and readers. So it's not a story to be taken literally in every element, but the main point is this openness to possibility and hospitality.
Okay? Something just dawned on me. Probably a lot of our parents fed hobos or bums or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
And then told us when we were kids, oh, you got to do that because you might entertain an angel unawares.
Yeah.
My mother used to do that because these people always found their way to our parsonage. But anyway, what if this is a joke about what if a bum showed up with just enough signs that it really was an angel? You know, and you know, you actually have a clue here and you still don't get it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just
Yeah, good analogy though. Yeah, that's right.
I thought of a poem I know about. It goes like this. It's written by a Native American. My men shall never work, for men who work cannot dream, and wisdom begins in dreams. And that violates the whole idea of hard work and the Protestant work ethic and all that stuff. And we feel guilty if we don't get to work. And guess what we did with those people?
Yeah.
We stuck them in reservations.
Yeah.
And it's almost parallel. That's what made me think of it,
yeah.
Is what's happened to this guy. you don't think like we do or look like we do, or we'll...
Yeah. Well, as so many writers of fiction say, you know, you need to read or listen to the story, live with it a bit, experience it. There's no necessity to have a one-sentence summary or the theme of this story is, because that's a violation of what every writer hopes, and that is that every word in the story is important, and it's the whole thing and the key moments in the story that are important for us to recognize. And it's the invisible travels, the invisible line of progress that is usually in the human spirit. And that's what we need to look for. And there's not much to be proud about in the human spirit of the parties to this story. And that's got to make us think, you know, where have I failed the angel unawares? Yes.
That's why I think it's so clever. You know, we're sitting there watching this happening, thinking, wow, this is really bizarre, you know?
Yeah.
We wouldn't do anything like that. But then you get done with the story and you say, yeah, but what would we do?
Yeah, what would we do? And it's hard to, we aren't very well prepared, most of us, to handle the unexpected, the unusual, especially if it's different from us. Dirty, unclean, rather, of another nationality and so forth.
I may be going off, way off base here, but as I looked at those words, I thought about how Jesus was treated when he was here. I mean, if people thought that God and the Messiah was going to come as a king, they certainly didn't expect to see an itinerant preacher going around doing the things that he did. And so thinking, I'm going to see an angel in white with golden wings and etc. In my idea of an angel, says
right.
somebody, and then this decrepit thing comes, and all those things you put on the board are the ways that Jesus was treated then, probably, and now.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, can it be, as you said, you gnaw on this and think about this story from a different perspective? But that's one of the things I thought of, is didn't expect to have Son of God come in that particular mode of
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect summary. And, you know, we realize that some stories don't provide full answers to anything, but they force the right questions on us. And I think this story does that quite well. Well, thank you. Thank you all.